military aid to the Israeli regime also violates the Lehi Law, which bans military aid to units engaged in systematic human rights violations. The Israeli regime armed forces provide many candidates. Congresswoman Betty McCollum has taken the lead in pursuing this initiative. Carrying it further should be a prime commitment for those concerned with U.S. support for the terrible Israeli regime crimes against Palestinians. Even a threat to the huge flow of aid could have a dramatic impact.
The subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Don and I welcome you back to another episode of the subcontinent. Since now I'll be taking a long leave, I would like you to meet our new host, Mr. Mehdi Golzadeh.
Thank you, John. Well, as he said, Mehdi Golzadeh. From now on, I'll be doing the rest of the episodes. Our episodes aim at to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
Please stay with us.
In this edition of the subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the deadly surge of the second wave of the COVID pandemic in India. Then we will explore how the Indian government has managed the catastrophe so far and its plans to stop the spread across the subcontinent.
Before we delve into our main story on the coronavirus pandemic in India, let's talk about another tragedy that has been plaguing the globe, Tatviri terrorism.
A car bomb was detonated across a school in the neighborhood of Adashto Barchi, and when students rushed out in panic, two more bombs exploded. The neighborhood is home to a large community of Shias from the Hazara ethnic minority, which has been often targeted by the extremists. More than 80 people were killed and about 150 more injured in the Saturday attack.
Teenage girls in Afghanistan are torn between fears and ambitions. Fear from the rising Takfiri presence in their country and ambitions of education and freedom. Being a schoolgirl in Afghanistan was already difficult, as they had to study in tattered tents or the open air, and the schools were desperately overcrowded without essential facilities such as toilets. But the hardships and threats they face outside school may change or even end their lives forever.
Indians are suffering from a devastating wave of pandemic like no country has ever experienced. Yes, it is true that the size of the population of the country makes it an arduous task to contain an epidemic of this magnitude. But the government's negligence about the second wave is taking a heavy toll on the people. My co-host Mehdi will walk you through some of the frightening figures.
The recent rise in the number of COVID cases has registered a peak in almost all the charts by the relevant authorities. India has recorded over 23 million cases of COVID, while the death toll is about 250,000. The weekly number of infections has averaged a record of over 390,000, while the country's daily coronavirus cases rose by 330,000, accounting for one in every three deaths reported worldwide each day.
The deadly surge in India's COVID cases has overwhelmed the subcontinent, and it may even grow to a global disaster. This second wave of the pandemic is larger and spreading more rapidly than the last one, and is also affecting more people across age groups, including children and infants. Since the start of April, daily infections have been soaring. People are gasping to stay alive as they wait for critical care beds and treatment. In addition to families, the increasing rise in infections has placed an enormous strain on health and critical care facilities. Hospitals cannot handle the load and families are scrambled for scarce medicines and oxygen cylinders or a doctor's appointment. In many cities, mass funeral pyres and cremations never stop in the parking lots that have been turned into crematoriums to accommodate the rising number of the dead. Dozens of bodies wash up on the banks of rivers every day, while the locals complain about the authorities' inaction to control the unbearable smell.
It is not hidden the fact that it's pretty out of control, especially last week. Now it looks a little bit under control this week and past 2 days. So if I analyze why it went out, probably there are multiple factors. One factor is related with the people. Means people were little bit complacent. They got vaccination, including healthcare worker. We thought that, okay, everybody was tired of mask. Everybody is tired of, not having, to get together with each other. So a human is a social person, isn't it? They try to find out the way to meet each other. So they started meeting, they thought that pandemic and now this virus is not going to come again. And even if it come and we are vaccinated, especially high-risk population got vaccinated. So one is that complacency from the people side. Second, they were, election rallies, they were farmer rallies. So probably people also thought, got a message that even at the highest level, probably this is not going to come. Thirdly, of course, it looks like some complacency from other like government agencies, and so nobody expected.
The World Health Organization has said that the variant of the COVID-19 behind the acceleration of India's explosive outbreak has been found in dozens of countries, not only in the subcontinent, but all over the world. According to the UN Health Agency, the B.1.617 variant had been detected in more than 4,500 samples uploaded to an open access database from 44 countries in all 6 regions of WHO. Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal are India's neighbors worst hit by the double mutant, while the UK has reported the largest number of COVID cases caused by the variant.
Lancet Medical Journal has said Modi's government should be held responsible for presiding over a self-inflicted national catastrophe. According to an estimate by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, that is an independent global health research center of the University of Washington, the deaths could potentially reach a staggering 1 million by August this year.
In the early days of 2021, India seemed to be on the path to normalcy when the daily positive cases were reported less than 10,000, the lowest in about 8 to 10 months. Vaccinations had started and hospitalization had decreased. India then started to open up and ease restrictions while the virus was evolving and mutating. Many research centers and organizations had predicted the second wave, but they did not know about the severity and when it would hit the country. But the government decided to ignore that. The Indian government's handling of the pandemic has created public uproar, while many in the world have pinned the blame on Prime Minister Modi for the new wave because he had ignored many warnings about the looming catastrophe. In early March, a forum of scientific advisors set up by the Modi administration had issued stern warnings of a new and more contagious variant taking hold in the country. This was after a parliamentary committee had warned of a shortage of oxygen in the coming months. Despite the warnings, the federal government did not seek to impose major restrictions to contain the spread of the virus. Some critics say arrogance, hypernationalism, and bureaucratic incompetence have combined to create a crisis of epic proportions as the government allowed religious gatherings and political rallies regardless of the facts. Millions of people, largely unmasked, attended election rallies for the 2021 assembly election that were held by Modi, leaders of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, and opposition politicians. The other super spreader event was Kumbh Mela, a major pilgrimage and festival in Hinduism. Millions of devotees took part in the gathering without any form of social distancing. The pilgrims then went back to their home states and catapulted the contagion.
This wave is different from the previous wave, and not only infectiousness, but the severity of infection is very high. So we are able to grasp the use of steroid in particular window that has helped us in decreasing the oxygen requirement in the patients. So everybody has learned over past 2 weeks, including government, including public, and including physicians and clinicians. And also people have started vaccinating themselves, and probably it may not help in this way, but of course we may be able to revert the third wave, which somebody projected that it may come.
India is the world's biggest producer of COVID vaccines, but shortages of the shots in some states have hindered the opening of inoculations for all adults. Some people say the shortage is because India exported about 60 million doses to 70 countries, but some experts believe the problem goes deeper. India produces over 2.5 million doses of vaccines every day. Even if it manages to vaccinate more than 2 million people per day, the nationwide vaccination will take over 2 years. Moreover, dozens of countries are sending large shipments of oxygen products to India, but the virus-hit country lacks the necessary means to distribute them to the people in need. Adding to the misery, there are also reports of deaths in people who had received both doses of their vaccines. The Indian double mutant may need new or moderated vaccine formulas.
If we look at the real-time experience of past 1 month, what I can say with some surety that those people who were vaccinated by Covishield actually didn't land up in major severe pneumonia. Now, when we talk about this is a total, very generalized statement. It has to have a lot of exceptions. Now, look at the other vaccines like Pfizer and Moderna. They also had 5,800 infections though there were not many much mutations, but without mutation there were so many breakthrough infections. So it's very hard to say that those vaccines can prevent mutation more effectively than Covishield. One, it's a time will tell. Second, at times the studies which are done in at a vitro level, at a vivo level, in a very small group of people, the studies been done, they were done when we didn't have so much mutation. So if you look at the efficacy of Moderna and Pfizer as compared to newer vaccine like Novavax and Johnson and Johnson, USAID and Covishield, these efficiencies of 90-95% were there when we had original Wuhan strain. Now, they have not been time tested with these type of triple mutation, double mutation, and which evades immunity. One. So one is not very sure, but since we haven't seen them, they haven't tested, so we feel that, okay, they may work. Because we are humans, we always feel that there is some hope. So I think we need more studies, and if this type of infection unfortunately strikes the places where people have been fully vaccinated by Pfizer and Moderna, then we'll come to know actual ground situation.
India spends only about 3% of its GDP on healthcare. The country is in serious need of infrastructure. The third wave of the pandemic is coming while the Indian variants have been spreading to the neighboring countries. If not contained, the Indian pandemic may be able to further deepen the global plague.
Listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Tina Thacker, Assistant Editor of The Economic Times. Now, Tina, why did the pandemic get out of hand in India?
So right now we are seeing a massive lethal wave of COVID virus in the country. We have variants which are circulating in India, but the variants are alone could not be blamed for the dramatic surge in cases and deaths seen in India. The country appeared to have let its guard down with huge social mixing and large gatherings. India felt that the crisis was over, dropping mask wearing and other protection measures, but the virus was quietly spreading. So here we are, we have seen big election rallies happening, and we have also seen religious, this festival where we saw huge gatherings, and this has all led to the situation, I would say.
How is the government handling the situation, and what grade do you give the Modi government?
That's a really sad part, that we are not just seeing COVID cases, but people have been dying due to inadequate supplies of oxygen, medicines, something which is as basic as hospital beds. People are not getting hospital beds. So the health infrastructure is actually crumbling, which is a really sad part and shows the sad state of affairs. Instead of government, Twitter has become the new helpline where strangers are helping each other, getting medicines, getting beds. I think government is doing its bit, but probably that's not enough, and the situation has got out of hand.
What can it do to reduce the severity of the disaster? Basically, what can we hope for?
So we have inoculated just about like less than 2% of the population right now. And given the size of the country, it's a Herculean task. Then there is a shortage of vaccines. We don't have enough supplies. We have only two companies which are supplying vaccines to the country. Though we expect more companies to get approval in days to come, we can hope for maybe, importing vaccines from other countries, like, for instance, US, which is not using the AstraZeneca vaccine, the supplies can be diverted to India. Then we have J&J, where people are hesitant to, take J&J, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So that's the only silver lining that we see right now, to get enough people getting vaccinated.
Who are the most hit in India, and what can be done for them?
We have to keep keep updating with the testing. We are not testing enough. We don't know if the testing has reached to the rural areas. So, and this time around, what we've seen is that the virus has impacted more young people, which is also in the productive age group, getting impacted because of the virus. So we have to at least ensure that the basic medical care is provided to them, at least to the people.
container will give you a break so we can see media and cyberspace.
Viruses mutate all the time, producing different versions or variants of themselves. Most of these mutations are significant, and some may even make the virus less dangerous, but others can make it more contagious and harder to vaccinate against. This variant, officially known as B1617, was first detected in India in October. Researchers in India are now trying to pinpoint what is behind the unprecedented surge, which could be due to an unfortunate confluence of factors, including the emergence of particularly infectious variants, a rise in unrestricted social interactions, and low vaccine coverage. Untangling the causes could be helpful to governments trying to suppress or prevent similar surges around the world. India's laboratories are struggling to keep up with the punishing COVID-19 surge as its scientists try to track and understand new coronavirus mutations. The World Health Organization has classified a variant first identified in India, known as B1617, as a variant of concern, saying preliminary studies suggested it may be more contagious than other variants. The WHO scientists didn't report any evidence that vaccines aren't effective against the new variant. India is in the process of ramping up its capacity to do genomic sequencing to track changes in the virus's genetic makeup by examining positive test samples. While experts suggest that the mortality rate in the second wave is similar to last year's wave, data shared by the Indian government clearly shows that the ratio of young adults in the 30 to 40 age group dying of the disease is higher than the first wave. This means there are more young children losing their parents, and some have been left totally alone as their entire immediate family has succumbed to the virus.
Tina, thank you for the wait. And now India's neighbors are already reporting cases of the Indian version. How long does it take for the wave to spread throughout the globe, and what happens then?
You know, so the variants have arisen in various parts of the world, including the British variant, which is the UK variant, which first entered in India, and we still have it. Now we have variants traveling abroad from India. We have South African variant, which has traveled to some places. So everybody has to keep a watch out for them. The main protection against them is only two things: prevent spreading by masking and by avoiding super spreading events. And second is to just, you know, ramp up vaccines so that people don't get seriously ill. That's what we can do right now.
Now, Tina, considering the large size and population of the country, is nationwide vaccination even possible? What is a feasible scenario? How long does it take, and how much vaccines are needed?
Yeah. So, you know, India is a vast country, but definitely it is possible. It will take a long time because we have shortage of vaccines. So, ideally, if you have plenty of vaccines available, you could go down to people as young as 18 years. But now that India has announced that they're going to vaccinate people who are above 18 plus, it's going to take some time because there are not enough vaccine supplies. So we have to just make sure that we have to protect our 45 plus population, because they are the ones who are most vulnerable. And maybe look at younger people with comorbidities. But we have to just use that rationing and triaging as long as we have got limited supplies of vaccines.
And one last question: how can the international community help the situation?
You know, as of now, we are getting a lot of foreign aid. A lot of countries have helped India in getting oxygen concentrators, medicines. So we have a lot of foreign aid coming in to India, which has really helped. India has been leading a push from lower and middle income countries at the World Trade Organization to do away patents on vaccines. So we'll have to see how other countries react to the same. Faced with this possibility of losing out on their profit margins and monopoly. We are hopeful now that the US has supported it. So we may see this coming, which would mean Not immediately, but maybe in the long run, we'll see more vaccines coming in, and it will be cheaper as well. So that's the silver lining that I see now.
Tina, thank you for your precious time, and we'd love to have you back on the program again. Now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and the cyberspace.
This account, named When the Flame Turns Blue, believes the Indian pandemic is now a global concern. Rojana Punjab has appreciated the Indian Navy's efforts to bring the much-needed oxygen tanks from abroad. Aksha Sharma has reflected concerns by an Indian blogger about the country's mismanagement of the pandemic before he succumbed to the disease. Niyati Bava has tweeted about an indigenous drug that may help in oxygen regulation in COVID patients.
All right, so that was our episode covering the second wave of the COVID pandemic in India. This was also my last episode as the host of this show, and I must say it has been an honor serving you for all this time. My colleague Mehdi now will carry the torch in our upcoming programs. On to Mehdi.
Thank you, John. We will meet again next week.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. 16 minutes and out. The purging of Liz Cheney from Republican leadership in the House of Representatives did not even go to a secret ballot. Instead, a voice vote was all it took to confirm the party's capitulation to Donald Trump and his big lie about a stolen election. But Liz Cheney went down swinging. Vowing to reporters on Capitol Hill, she said, "I will do everything I can to ensure that the former president never gets again anywhere near the Oval Office." Then using a high-profile television interview to say of would-be challengers for a seat in Wyoming, "Bring it on." The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist David Smith. The piece is titled, "Can Never Trump Republicans Gain Party Control? Or is it a lost cause?" Out. The purging of Liz Cheney from Republican leadership in the House of Representatives did not even go to a secret ballot. Instead, a voice vote was all it took to confirm the party's capitulation to Donald Trump and his big lie about a stolen election. But Liz Cheney went down swinging. Vowing to reporters on Capitol Hill, she said, "I will do everything I can to ensure that the former president never again gets anywhere near the Oval Office." Then using a high-profile television interview to say of would-be challengers for a seat in Wyoming, "Bring it on." The public defiance instantly turned Cheney into one of the leaders of the Never Trump movement of disaffected Republicans. But it also raised strategic questions over the future direction of that movement and whether it can still regain control of the Republican Party or should now abandon it as a lost cause. Some insist that the party of Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan was their home long before Donald Trump's populist fantasist invasion, and they will fight to drive him out. Others believe that it is time to abandon ship and their future lies as independents or Democrats or even perhaps in a breakaway party. "We're torn," said Joe Walsh, a former congressman from Illinois. "I left the Republican Party a year ago. Liz Cheney isn't there yet." Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who I know well, isn't there yet. "They want to still try to reform and save the Republican Party. I don't think it can be saved." So there's a split in the never-Trump world, and most never-Trumpers still agree with Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. Let's try to reform the party from within. "I just don't think it's reformable. They still harbor ideas that the Republican Party can be wrestled away from Donald Trump. It can't be." Joe Walsh, who mounted a long-shot challenge to Donald Trump for the Republican nomination last year, believes that a third political party is now the only solution. "We are at a weird moment in American history where, because the Republican Party has become a cult, there's an opportunity to start something new. I think eventually that's where everybody's going to get to." On Thursday, a coalition of more than 150 anti-Trump Republicans started a political movement, urging the party to turn its back on extremism and lies. Members of A Call for American Renewal include lawyer George Conway, husband of former White House counselor Kellyanne Conway, and Anthony Scaramucci, ex-White House communications director, as well as 27 former members of the House of Representatives. The group stopped short of proposing a new political party, for now. Co-organizer Evan McMullen, who ran for president as an independent in Utah in 2016, said, "We definitely don't rule it out, but our preference is to reform the Republican Party, not necessarily from within. I think most of us believe that the only way to reform the Republican Party at this point is to act independently of it. It means that we will support good Republicans who are upholding the rule of law and defending and promoting truth and the Constitution. But we'll also support viable independents where they exist. If we have to support a unifying Democrat in order to defeat an extremist Republican, we're going to do that. If it's Senator Mark Kelly in Arizona running for re-election against extremist Kelly Ward, then we're going to be for Captain Mark Kelly." Evan McMullen, a former CIA operations officer, added, "I think in this next cycle, we'll have people who will run under our banner, people who are in office now, people who are capable of mounting credible campaigns for public office. We will invite all to associate with our principles regardless of their party registration and to run as part of this effort." Other initiatives in the Never Trump universe include the Lincoln Project, Principles First, the Republican Accountability Project, and the Bulwark website. Adam Kinzinger, who with Liz Cheney was among 10 House Republicans to vote for Trump's impeachment after the 6th of January insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, launched a group called Country First to recruit and back anti-Trump Republican candidates. Liz Cheney herself now has a platform guaranteed by her family name. Her father was George W. Bush's vice president, Dick Cheney, and looks set to be a more prominent voice than retired senators such as Bob Corker and Jeff Flake. She is reportedly planning more travel and media interviews and a political operation to support candidates who share her contempt for Donald Trump's false claims of election fraud. Larry Sabato, director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, said, "Liz Cheney has positioned herself to be a prominent spokesperson for the old-style Republicans, but also a very conservative party that does not kneel before an authoritarian, which is what the others are doing. She deserves the position that she has just earned, Now, that's not to say she's going to be elected president. She's pretty far to the right. But how can you not admire her for sacrificing the power she has now and maybe her seat? There are some signs that Donald Trump's sway over the Republican Party is not what it used to be. His favorability rating among Republicans in December was 91%, with 74% holding a very favorable view, an Economist YouGov opinion poll found. This month, however, the same survey showed him at 78% favorability, with 58% very favorable. But congressional Republicans appear to have concluded they cannot fight next year's midterm elections without Donald Trump. Kevin Madden, a former advisor to Mitt Romney, now a senator for Utah and outspoken Trump critic, is in no doubt that a long haul lies ahead for Never Trumpers. What is the plan to mobilize and grow that movement, and is that best done inside the party or outside of the party, he asked. What is the calendar of action on that? Anybody who thinks that this is going to be waged between now and the midterm elections, or now and 2024, is probably being very unrealistic. The more realistic scenario is that if Liz Cheney is to be believed about her dedication in this respect, today is the first day of what is probably a decades-long battle for the direction of the Republican Party. A breakaway remains unlikely, with the odds stacked against anybody trying to shake up America's two-party political system. Competing with Democrats and Republicans' vast fundraising machines would be daunting. In the first-past-the-post electoral system, a third party would struggle to convince people that their vote would not be wasted in hundreds of districts. Madden, who became an independent last year, and wrote in the name of Lynn Cheney, mother of Liz Cheney, on his presidential election ballot, added, "The work of building the infrastructure to compete across 50 different states or 435 different congressional districts, that is a monumental undertaking."
Economic divide.
It's all about the cash and what it can do. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Economic Divide. I'm Kavitah Wei. Money represents the hundreds of millions of dollars that, to some degree, dictate U.S. policy both within and outside the U.S., including the U.S. presidential elections. That is the topic of our show for today. Now, coming up in today's program, what is dark money? We will discuss the definition and all the different forms that it has in U.S. politics. From super PACs to election money donations, you'll be surprised how the law allows that to happen. Many countries and billionaires actually have been doing that. Which foreign countries spend the most in the U.S.? We're going to take a look at that. The figures will surely surprise you. Over $2 billion since 2016 and counting. Even think tanks are not exempt. And then finally, we're going to take a look at Arab countries. We'll zoom in on some of them, the money they spend lobbying in the U.S., in particular Saudi Arabia. You would be shocked the degree of control they yield over U.S. lawmakers. In some cases, the text is written for them.
Thank you.
money and politics. They go hand in hand. No country is exempt. But in the U.S., things have gone to a whole other level. Large quantities of money, undisclosed and unlimited. This influential money is commonly referred to as dark money. And so far, hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent in the U.S. political system, including from foreign countries. First, the cash. How much? Over $2.5 billion since 2016. Money spent through 574 foreign principals. The top countries are as follows. Figures could be a lot higher, since many front companies represent these countries, which makes it harder to track.
The last thing I want to do is get rich with as little work possible. That's really what I'm trying to do as the bad guy, right? So is there anything preventing me from holding stocks, say, in an oil or gas company, and then writing laws to deregulate that industry and cause, you know, that could potentially cause the stock value to soar and accrue a lot of money in that time?
You could do that.
Is it possible that any elements of this story apply to our current government and our current public servants right now?
Yes.
Yes.
So we have a system that is fundamentally broken. We have these influences existing in this body, which means that these influences are here in this committee shaping the questions that are being asked of you all right now.
Money and politics go hand in hand. That is a given. But to what extent is that true in the U.S.? That's what we want to find out today. The Money Trail, why it's called dark money, and how do the ones donating keep their identity a secret? Let's get some definitions out of the way. There's this thing called dark money. Dark money refers to money received and then spent in politics. Logically, this is called political spending. There's nothing wrong with that. Let's just follow the money trail now. Now, this political spending is done by three organizations, which are nonprofit organizations. They are social welfare, unions, and also trade associations. Doesn't sound that bad, does it? Nothing wrong with that so far. Well, here's where things get murky. First, these organizations can receive unlimited donations. Note, unlimited. Second, and most controversial, is that they're not required to disclose their donors. That's right, no need to disclose their donors. Who can the donors be? Individuals, which is okay, and corporations, which according to most Americans, is not okay. Second, these organizations can receive unlimited donations from corporations and individuals. Now note, unlimited donations. Now third, who can they get unlimited money from? Not only are Americans not happy with the unlimited money part, which has involved many American billionaires, some U.S. lawmakers have actually voiced their anger about this. This was especially voiced during the 2020 U.S. presidential elections.
I have really had it with billionaires, regardless of party, who think that the rules don't apply to them. I've had it with billionaires who think their money buys them something special.
All right, that was former U.S. presidential candidate and Massachusetts lawmaker Elizabeth Warren. So how much money are we talking about when it comes to the spending that does not disclose or is being disclosed from their donors? Well, back in 2006, it was $5.2 million. And then look, in 2012, the amount skyrocketed to $300 million in the presidential cycle. So a big boost in dark money spending between the years 2006 and 2012. And that's just in the span of 6 years. Let's fast forward 8 years from that date to the year 2020. You won't believe the dark money spent in the 2020 presidential elections. It was more than $1 billion. And here's a breakdown. The FEC spending came out to be about $88 million. Then came digital ad spending, $132 million for that. And then TV ad spending, that was $170 million. And $660 million came in at contributions from political groups. Why is that important? Don't you think that there are favors that need to be done for those donations? You bet there are, and many include billionaires and corporations for the most part. Now, many Americans view this as undemocratic.
The danger to democracy of foreign money in U.S. elections is that it's really a fundamental attack on American democracy. And the more of this information that's sort of hidden behind closed doors, the less accountability we're going to have in U.S. politics, and the greater the opportunities become for foreign money and foreign influence to sneak in and affect U.S. elections.
All right, even the former U.S. president openly admits not only is this true, well, his party is actually guilty of it. Check this out.
Essentially, I would say anything goes. There are no rules in terms of how to finance campaigns. There aren't a lot of functioning democracies around the world that work this way, where you can basically have millionaires and billionaires bankrolling whoever they want, however they want, in some cases undisclosed. And what it means is ordinary Americans are shut out of the process. And Democrats aren't entirely innocent of this in the past. And, you know, I had to raise a lot of money for my campaign.
All right, you heard him there. Even the former U.S. president's openly admitting not only is this true, his party is guilty of it. In terms of what kind of donations are taking place. Well, take a look at this in terms of the Democrats and how much dark money was dominating the 2020 elections. I mean, in terms of the foreign money, may have very well decided the 2020 elections in favor of the current U.S. President Joe Biden. I mean, you don't need to see what the story is by just looking at here, the Republicans coming in way short in terms of the money that was donated there. Roughly about $300 million as opposed to what the Democrats received, which, as you can see, was over $500 million. Well, let me bring in William Still. He is an economist and also author of The Money Masters, in which he believes in debt-free U.S. notes and ending fractional reserve banking. He also believes that the Federal Reserve should actually end. Okay, Bill, money in U.S. politics is that's nothing new. As you're well aware, this affects and impacts government decision-making. First, let's take a look at foreign governments, companies, and other entities which pay foreign agents to influence U.S. policy and opinion in pursuit of their own interests. Of course, that includes think tanks. You then have lobbyists within the U.S. who are courting lawmakers and presidential candidates in the U.S. elections. Can you please explain the differences and how it works?
This is one of the most corrosive, corrupt influences in the U.S. political system. It's a very good question that you ask, and I'm afraid I can't explain it logically or ethically, because within the past 12 to 18 months, the U.S. System of equal justice under the law has just totally collapsed, and we're now in this horrible morass of a combination of corrupt politics combined with a corrupt worldwide medical system. For the first time, the medical world has been corrupted totally by Big Pharma, to where they're no longer serving the public interest. They're no longer serving the Hippocratic oath of do no harm. They're now serving the financial interests of corporate Big Pharma to their everlasting discredit. And it's going to take medicine worldwide, not just in the United States, decades, if not generations, to recover from this.
Dark money is everywhere in U.S. politics. It shapes the Americans' psyche on who to elect, from governors to presidents. This includes money in ads and mail.
Under Obama's plan, you wouldn't have to work and wouldn't have to train for a job. They just send you your welfare check.
What we're seeing now is someone like Adelson promising to spend $100 million on campaigns. You know, us average Americans, no matter how many of us you put together, we could never amass $100 million. And that's just one person we're trying to fight against. I mean, I'm rooting for the internet and technology to try helping Americans have a voice, but right now we are getting completely, totally drowned out.
A lot of reasons not to elect me.
It's really hard to get away from ads. Sometimes the same candidate will have ads, multiple ads during like the same commercial break. So, you know, it gets a little, I'm not sure how helpful it is.
Where did all the Obama stimulus money go? Friends, donors, campaign supporters, special interest groups.
It gets to the point where that's pretty much all I see sometimes. And it's also a little funny because I'll see one and then immediately afterwards I'll see another one that contradicts it.
They send out all these mailings. They don't care if they lie.
Nobody knows who they are. They call them dark money groups, and that's exactly what they are.
Corporation funnels money to a dark money group. They send out postcards attacking the opponent. When that candidate gets elected, they support the agenda of the corporation.
I don't know how to fight them. I can't pick up the phone and say, hey, what's your interest in candidate X? Because I don't know who they are.
You wouldn't think foreign government money is behind it, but they are. Even U.S. think tanks are flooded with foreign money.
When people say there's too much money in politics, I say, well, how much is too much? Who gets to define that? And if elected officials and incumbents get to decide how much is too much, then they're limiting the citizens' ability to engage in the political process.
Even after the elections, we're still not going to be sure what the final numbers are because there's so much lack of disclosure going on.
Out of 237 think tanks, 70% did not disclose their donors. Some of these think tanks are influential in shaping U.S. foreign policy. But governments abroad shaping U.S. foreign policy in broad daylight? That is the case. Countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE have been influencing Washington through lobbyists, think tanks, journalists, and academia. Not only is legislation prepared by their lobbyists all the time, lobbyists actually script what various members of Congress say. In one case, Rep. Ed Royce spoke on the House floor against ending U.S. support for the war on Yemen. His talking points were written by lobbyists for Saudi Arabia. That means a lobbyist was retained and paid for by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, according to federal disclosure forms, in order to undermine congressional opposition to the Yemen war.
You know, I had to raise a lot of money for my campaign. There's nobody who operates in politics that has perfectly clean hands on this issue. But what is also true is that all of us should bind ourselves to some rules that say the people who vote for us should be more important than somebody who's spending $1 million, $10 million, or $100 million to help us get elected. Because we don't know what their agendas are. We don't know what their interests are. And I continue to believe that Citizens United contributed to some of the problems we're having in Washington right now.
Okay, let's bring in our guest for this segment of the program. His name is Bob Barker. He's a U.S. economist. He also works at the Schiller Institute as an agricultural liaison. Bob, welcome. Let's take a look at countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE. They have been influencing Washington through lobbyists, think tanks, journalists, academia, and the likes. If U.S. authorities are aware of this, why do they allow this to happen again and again?
You look in the various countries like Saudi Arabia and these big oil-based economies, and you see the influence that they have. You've got to be thinking about who's pulling the strings behind the scenes, because this is the influence of these old networks. Going back to London, and how they have got their ability to manipulate and influence things globally. So you manipulate the energy, the oil, or as I was saying before, you take the Green New Deal. And now that's a major shift because of the financial breakdown. These old empire-oriented companies are trying to restructure their control through financing of green infrastructure, windmills, and then also the carbon footprint, where they want to buy and sell carbon. And that is like the camouflage, because that mechanism is a mechanism to take over all farmland and control the food production beyond belief.
Wow, fascinating stuff there from Bob. Well, what many don't realize is how the Green New Deal, as he mentioned, is actually going to become mainstream sooner than anyone can imagine. And along with that, an industrial revolution of sorts to follow. And of course, the lobbyists will be there. It's time to take a quick break here on Economic Divide, but do stay with us. We have plenty more coming up after a short break. Welcome back. This is our Info News section. First item that we are going to take a look at is regarding post-Brexit clashes. Yes, this has occurred already, and it's between France and the UK. Now, this particular piece of news said French fishermen protested over rules on fishing rights in an area called Jersey. They're angry that they must now provide proof that they have historically fished in those waters since Britain left the European Union. French boats, in one instance, rammed the UK boat. Now, that is what's called gunboat diplomacy. Okay, moving on to our next item, U.S. employment. Well, it's facing a bit of a conundrum, which is really unexplainable. You see, on the one hand, it is reported that there's a shortage of workers in that country in a wide array of industries, from restaurants to factories. Now, at the same time, job numbers were out this past week. And shockingly, the U.S. economy only added 266,000 jobs for the month of April. That's far less than the 1 million jobs that was forecasted to be added. So much for a U.S. economic recovery. On to cryptocurrency. Big warning came from the European Central Bank, or the Bank of England, I should say, where it said that investors should be prepared to lose all their money. It said digital currencies actually have no intrinsic value. That doesn't mean to say that people don't put value on them, according to them, because they have extrinsic value. But that's a warning that crypto investors should actually heed. Something tells me, however, that they're not going to do that. And finally, our look at the final topic that we chose concerns food and hunger. Global hunger crisis to have hit five-year high in 2020 as 155 million people faced severe food insecurity. This was a warning that came from the UN. And this is on top of a report that stated rising global food prices or food inflation could lead to social unrest.
This episode of my Time to Wake Up series what we see is an operation that has brought big anonymous special interests to the table where justices are selected by virtue of their writing big checks. And the vehicle for this has been the Federalist Society, which has a fine role on college campuses as a conservative discussion and student group, which has a relatively fine role in Washington as a think tank, as fine as think tanks are. But it also has this additional role of taking money from big special interests, not disclosing who they are, and giving them a seat at the table when the Federalist Society is selecting justices, and that is wrong.
Is there something about the way that money has been spent under Citizens United that contributes to the thick fog of propaganda that overhangs our politics today?
Well, I think anything that undermines disclosure makes it harder for us to find out who's behind what we're seeing online. I mean, people get all sorts of information online, and I don't think anybody wants to get their news from a Russian troll farm, but people didn't realize that's where they were getting the information from last time. So to the extent that Citizens United has undermined disclosure, I think it has also contributed.
Okay, let's talk to William Still for this section of our Q&A. Bill, the notion of dark money from foreign countries is our focus in this question. How do you see it when countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, or the UAE are are influencing Washington through lobbyists, think tanks, journalists, and academia. I mean, how did it get to this point for the U.S.?
You know, you mentioned Saudi